Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay? There's two of them, and they just, they're acting fine the whole time. They're on board, I can say that.
Oh, my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh, Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Come on, Lisa, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular
disc. Sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a
brake if I was. For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us. Nobody
told me that these days like this. Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Yes, these certainly are strange days indeed, and this program reflects the UFO side of the strangeness. Welcome to those of you listening here in Toronto and in Montreal, around the world on the web via the live stream, and to you wherever you are via the podcast, to program number 396. Wherever you're listening, we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at sdi@virtuallystrange.net. Tonight, Dave Frelott with his take on it, British correspondent Stuart Miller, who earlier today staged his UFO Review magazine Ufology and the Paranormal Conference in Altrincham in Cheshire in the UK. And in studio tonight, Wayne St. John. Evening, Wayne.
Good evening, Errol. How you doing?
Good. And good to have you back, and looking forward to part deux of the story of David.
Indeed so.
And that will happen in the fourth quarter of this program. And ET Contact is the series that Wayne is producing for us. And as I said, David, who's had amazing personal contact with beings from a craft right here in Toronto.
Good old T.O.
Yes,
indeed.
Queen and Leslie, even.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sad news this week. Carl Flock, author, consultant, and UFO researcher, passed away this week. He was a consulting senior editor for Arlington House Publishers, editor of Libertarian Review, a senior editor at the American Enterprise Institute, contributing editor to Reason, and science columnist for Eternity Science Fiction. His articles on UFOs have appeared just in all of the UFO trades. And he has made significant contributions to other U.S. and foreign publications, too. Carl Flock was a popular speaker at UFO and Anomalous Phenomena gatherings and was named 1998's Ufologist of the Year by the National UFO Conference. In the late 60s and early 70s, this is interesting stuff. Pay attention here. In the late 60s and 70s, he served as a member and chairman of the National Capital Area Investigations Subcommittee of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, then the world's largest private UFO organization. And then as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense, the Deputy Director for Operational Test and Evaluation, between 1985 and 89, Carl Flock guided development and implementation of Department of Defense policy governing weapon systems and equipment testing. He also managed congressional media and public affairs for the Operational Test and Evaluation Office. In recognition of his contributions, he was awarded the Defense Outstanding Public Service Medal and the Defense Superior Achievement Award. Still more. In the House of Representatives, Mr. Flock was Special Assistant for Defense, Space, Science, and Technology to then-Congressman Ken Cramer between 83 and 85, a ranking member of the House Committee on Armed Services. Carl Flock was also a CIA operative, which caused a bit of conflict, confliction, I guess, for one or two people in the UFO field. His passing was made public by his friend Herb Taylor on the Project 1947 email list last Tuesday. And on Thursday, Herb wrote to the Project 1947 list, "It was always a pleasure to converse with Carl, and one of the many items that we discussed was the problem of the black triangles. Because of the positions that he formerly held, I felt it best to keep what he said confidential. With his sad passing, though, these restrictions are no longer necessary. Carl often hinted that most black triangle reports were observations of a classified government project. I believe that he made similar comments on the Project 1947 list during discussions on the matter. The triangles, the black flying triangles, were discussed during an instant message exchange on April 2nd back in 2002, the relevant extracts of which are as follows. Herb says, re the large black triangles, Carl. Do you think the day will come when this becomes public knowledge, such as the stealth aircraft? Flock replied, no comment, laugh out loud, I really can't discuss it. Herb again, I understand your predicament, but you do know for a fact that this is the answer to the large black triangles? Just want to clarify things in my own mind, to which Flock responded, well, I can say this, it has nothing to do with captured alien technology or any cooperation with aliens, etc. Well, it's at least the answer to most of them, including the recent Illinois case. Herb, again, do the Hudson Valley, New York sightings of the early mid-1980s fall into this category? Carl Flock, I think we best stop discussing this topic, Herb. And again, Herb says, you make reference to the recent Illinois case. Was that the one on January 5th, 2000? No, I won't ask any further questions. Maybe someday this hopefully will become common knowledge. Herb Taylor on Carl Flock. Since Wendy Connors was last on, and we had planned to have her back a few weeks ago, unfortunately, Wendy was unwell and is now on a regimen of changed medications, which will help her breathe more easily, which is one of the reasons that she's down in Albuquerque, New Mexico. But Wendy kindly sent me a clip this week, and it has to do with the last time she was on, when a caller wanted to know about UFOs making sounds, and those sounds being recorded. So Wendy said in her email to me, here's a perfect response to that caller's astute question. On March 14, 1978, in Jefferson, New York, a woman and her mother observed a UFO over their house. The object gave off a humming sound during the interview of the witness by Robert Gribble, the founder of the National UFO Reporting Center. The sound is caught on tape, and what Wendy did was to isolate the sound of the humming and removing most of the ambient noise, such as breathing by the witness and Bob Gribble. So the first segment of the recording is the actual conversation, then with sound boosted, the sound of the object outside her home. The third segment is the same sound, the sound of the object outside her house, digitally cleaned. So what you'll hear is quite possibly an actual sound made by a solid UFO over a house in Jefferson, New York in 1978.
Did you hear any sound by any chance?
Yes. There was a humming noise, and we could hear it right now. It's right over the house.
Right now?
Yes.
Okay.
I know it wasn't an airplane. I know damn well what I saw.
Now digitally cleaned up. Yes, isn't that interesting? Perhaps we'll play that again a little later for those people who join us a little later.
These These are strange days indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Berloff.
We're an easygoing people here in Canada, and many outsiders might even consider us to be soft, easy, even gullible. But they do so at their own peril, because Canadians are anything but soft, easy, and gullible. Our military track record speaks for itself. There are 17 people that will be going on trial to face charges because, presumably, they thought we were soft, easy, and gullible. We're an easy target. We don't have a large military force. Heck, our national police force still have a contingent that rides around on horses. How good can they be? Not only that, but we don't even do anything to hide our espionage agency. Matter of fact, CSIS does recruiting drives to try and get secret agents to sign up. But you see, that's the thing with Canada and Canadians. We don't shout things from the rooftops. We don't beat our chests and try to rally the troops. We simply deal with the problem quietly. We wait, we watch, we gather information, and then, when the time comes, we gather up the garbage before it blows all over the place. Kudos to CSIS, the RCMP, and any other forces that were involved in taking care of business in the Canadian way. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for efforts and your hard-won success at gathering up that group of suspected terrorists. I now trust that our judicial system will determine their guilt or innocence, and the innocent shall be freed, while the guilty will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. Now, what does this all have to do with UFOs, you're probably asking? And that's a fair question. It's simple. It shows the nature of Canadians. Not only Canadians involved with government, military, and police organizations, but also regular citizens. We're laid-back people, but we keep vigilant watch on things that interest us, and only when the time is right do we act. I believe that the need for disclosure concerning UFOs in Canada is going to come about just in that manner. We won't have the government making loud proclamations or agencies trying to stop the effort or compartmentalizing it by hiding behind national secrecy acts. Disclosure is not going to happen in Canada as though it were an atomic explosion. It's going to be more like a gentle rising tide. Now, those of us interested in UFOs and disclosure are not going to force the government to do anything. We're going to watch, we're going to wait, we're going to ask some questions, we're going to gather some information, and we're going to ask some more questions. Until finally, disclosure is going to happen simply as a matter of course. I believe that disclosure about UFOs and aliens and all the government knows about them will happen here in Canada long before it's going to happen in the United States. And for no other reason than we're a different country and we do things a little differently than our southern cousins. That doesn't mean we're better or we're more efficient, we're just different. Government and ex-government officials are slowly beginning to come online now. They're beginning to ask questions themselves about this strange enigma known as ufology. And that's what it's going to take. It's not a bunch of ufologists asking the government for answers, but basically ufologists helping, providing information to members of the government so that they can ask the questions for us. 17 people that believed Canadians were easy, soft, and stupid have found out the hard way that we do things differently in this country. And I believe that ufologists from all over the globe shall also discover that here in Canada, we do things a little differently. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Berloff, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
We don't do things differently than anybody else. We just a much more lower profile, I think, is what it is.
Well, lower profile, but yes. That's different.
Yes, shy, quiet, retiring, and modest.
Not necessarily in that order.
Well, no, no, no. Good take, though, Dave.
Thank you.
I've been getting some complimentary email about your takes of late, I have to tell you.
Yes, I noticed that. Thank you.
Well, hey, you know, it's credit where credit is due, and I know you work your buns off all week preparing for tonight, and we appreciate it greatly.
Hey, it's one of those things. It's fun. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's happening with your book of takes?
No, that's a very good question. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I've got it. I mean, I've got a bunch of... I've got actually two big volumes of takes.
I guess.
But
we're almost up to program 400.
Yeah.
We will be in about 4 weeks. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it's... I mean, it's pretty wild. It's just a matter of, I think I need to find the correct publishers.
Well, that seems to be becoming increasingly difficult.
Yeah. It's just, it can't be my regular publisher for my other work.
For your novels, yeah.
So it's going to have to be, I'm going to have to find me another publisher that's willing to put that one out there. So
and if you want to find out which other books we're talking about and you haven't visited Dave's profile page, if you click on Dave's image on the program listing page, it'll take you there and you can read all about Dave and his other books and how to get a hold of them. Thank you a lot, Dave, for a lot.
Oh, thank you.
And we shall talk to you next week.
For sure.
And as several people have said, keep up the good work.
All right.
Yeah, never mind the mediocre stuff. Just big, meaty, and bouncy is the way we like it.
Yeah.
Good night, Dave.
Good night.
It is that time of the month, the second Saturday of the month, when we travel across the pond to the United Kingdom, wherein dwells Stuart Miller, our British correspondent. A kind of a busy day for Stuart today. He staged the Conference on Ufology and the Paranormal in Timperley in Cheshire, Altrincham area. Mr. Miller joins us on the line, assuming that because he had to get up real early this morning, he's not almost dead on his feet. Evening, Stuart.
Good evening, Alan. I'm full of the joys of life.
Are you really?
I am.
Good. And the conference went well?
Oh, the conference went well, yes. A poor audience.
Really?
Yeah, it was expected. But
yeah, well, I mean, so your worries about it being England's first game in the World Cup,
yes,
the football World Cup, made a difference, huh?
It did, yeah.
Oh, too bad.
But the conference itself was excellent, and it's a very good venue, and you know, we'll probably be going back there again.
Oh, good. Good.
Oh, yes, I'm down but not finished.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. You know, it's really disappointing when you work your buns off to put something on like this and people don't show.
Well, we had an audience, but it wasn't very substantial. There was one particularly attractive young lady in the audience. the speakers, I must say, were absolutely excellent.
Yes. At least a couple of the names of speakers we are familiar with here. We've had them both on the program. One being from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Paul Kimball.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Nick Redfern, who has thrown all kinds of stuff against the fan and watched it fly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, author, researcher, and the man who wrote the most recent book on Roswell. Yeah, very interesting. So they were good. Who else did you have, Stuart Miller?
We had Neil Morris, who spoke on your favorite subject, Errol, the alien autopsy. Well, I know it's not de rigueur to talk about that anymore, but I just can't help it, Errol.
Okay,
I just can't help it.
Feel free, Stuart. It's your segment. You do with it what you will.
Well, we just come back to the very basic question, the very first question that you might ask when you're considering the alien autopsy footage, which is, where did Ray Santelli get the clock? Where did he get the telephone? Where did he get the authentic autopsy table? Because he was nothing more than a backstreet video pirate, and you couldn't get the brains to do his trousers up, let alone organize something like that. And when you ask that question, and you ask that question of Santilli, of course you never get an answer.
Mm.
That's the whole frustrating thing about it. It's just... But I think Neil Morris is convinced there is more to it. Nobody's shouting about it anymore because nobody wants to be shouted down.
Mm.
So Neil and one or two others will just carry on quietly. And I don't think, I hate to say this, Errol, but I do not think we have heard the end of this.
I'm sure we haven't. But on the subject of where did he get the clock, where did he get the telephone, the autopsy table, you realize, of course, that there are professional hunters down of that kind of stuff for movies and television series. So.
Yeah, but he did it on the cheap. He did. I mean, well, that's just one thing. I mean, it's, you know, there are other strange elements to the whole thing as well. And Neil's talk was very illuminating on it.
Mm-hmm.
He covered every point. I think there was even one or two bits of information in there that I hadn't heard before.
Oh.
And he seemed to have the audience's attention.
Well, good. Well, good. I mean, it would be disappointing to have him speak there and nobody.
The fourth speaker was a guy called Dave Sadler who changed his topic. He was going to speak about the most haunted house in England, but instead actually spoke about something very interesting. I actually forget the name of what they are, but a couple of standing stones down in Congleton. Ali looked, and there's a lot of paranormal activity that's gone on around there, and it is very interesting, very absorbing.
Hmm.
You do realize, in case you are hearing noises in the background, that I have with me two people who spoke at the conference, two people that you mentioned earlier.
Oh, good.
In at the moment, and
oh, good.
Are having difficulty controlling themselves. It's Mr. Redfern and Mr. Gimble. Hey, Errol. Something.
Hello, Nick. Oh. Hello, Paul.
Hey. How's it going?
It's going well, thank you. I guess you guys must be pretty much zonked now, huh? It's
somewhat.
Somewhat. Well,
I'm still on Atlantic Standard Time, Errol, so I'm fine.
Oh, good.
I'm not sure what time I'm on.
Yeah. Well, bath salts always work with that jet lag, you know. As soon as you arrive wherever it is that you're going, you leap into a tub full of hot water and Epsom salts. And then you do the same when you come back, and the jet lag just goes away.
Well, Stuart has the world's largest coffee tea mugs in his house, so right now I'm halfway through what seems to be a quart of tea. So, yeah, that's keeping me awake.
Well, good. Congratulations. So a good day for you both as far as your talks were concerned, I guess, huh?
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, pretty good, Errol. I did the my Source of Spies book and just spoke basically about how and why government agencies watch people in the UFO subject and the various reasons that this has been undertaken, you know, going right back to the days of people like George Adamski and George Van Tassel,
mm-hmm.
and up to the present day with people like computer hacker Gary McKinnon, and, you know, just try to do a concise history of what happened and et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, sorry, Errol. It's Paul here. I just wanted to say that you know, Nick's talk was really dull. it just dragged on and on for what seemed like forever. So.
Oh, my. So. I was going to add that...
by the way.
Yes, I'm just joking, of course.
Really?
kidding, by the way.
mentioning Gary McKinnon, I don't know if either of you recall the name Billy Cox. Billy Cox is a columnist with Florida Today, and he wrote a really interesting piece this week, which is in the news and info section, linked to tonight's program listing, and tying in Gary McKinnon with the deaths of some scientists who were into all kinds of interesting research over the last 20, 30 years, sort of deeply black projects. And if you haven't read it, go take a look at it. I don't want to get into it too much now, but I just wanted to get that in because Billy wrote a really interesting column this week. Mm-hmm.
When Errol, this is Stuart here. When you
yes, it is. I recognize the voices.
When you say the death of some, what was it, microbiologist?
No, I think they were much more. I'm just trying to.
Are you referring to the guys in the UK that died?
No, in the States even.
Right.
Yeah. Let me see if I can get to it quickly while you cover for me, Stuart.
Right. Okay. Well.
It's titled Another Tactical Blunder for Bush.
Oh, yes. I found that one interesting.
It was the hunt for zero-point energy. And mentions, of course, Nick Cook, who was with Jane's Defense Weekly. And Cook was mystified over what happened to the anti-gravity research conducted by Martin Aircraft, Bell Aircraft, yada, yada, yada. And that's enough of a tease for people. You should go to tonight's program listing, link to it, and go read Billy Cox's article. Up from their beds tonight across the Atlantic Ocean, over there in the United Kingdom, British correspondent Stuart Miller, publisher of UFO Review, and two of the speakers who were at the conference which Stuart organized earlier today in Cheshire. We have Nick Pope and Paul Kimball, both very interesting dudes in their own right. We had started to get into, oh yeah, how boring Nick Pope's, Nick Pope. Oh, God. And it's not the first time I've done it, is it, Nick Redfern?
No, I don't think it is, actually.
Oh, my.
It's kind of funny to be serious with Nick Pope.
I have to say, Errol, I was just kidding before the break. Nick's lecture was one of the most exciting things I've heard since Ken Dryden's last speech in the House of Commons. It was riveting. Absolutely riveting stuff.
Why, goalkeeping politicians or goalkeeper politicians or political goalkeepers are not boring, to quote M. Python. Yeah. See, now Paul Kimball has the audience confused. Now, was he being sarcastic or was he being truthful and honest?
That's a mystery.
You never know with me, do you? That's the thing.
And that's the whole thing. So did you go over there, Paul Kimball, specifically to speak at this conference, or are you doing stuff for your documentary as well?
No, I'm over interviewing Nick Pope, actually. although I'm not sure now. Am I interviewing Nick Pope or Nick Redfern? I don't know. I'm over shooting some footage for the Best Evidence top 10. You're holding signs up telling me to say things. I've been kidnapped.
Uh-huh.
By the Brits. That's what's happened.
Yes.
They're not letting me leave unless I become controversial. So,
okay, go ahead.
No, I'm over doing some filming for top 10. I happen to be here. And I thought it would be a perfect opportunity to give the lecture that dare not speak its name in Canada or the United States, which is why Wilbert Smith is a load of crap.
I believe
I actually used that word in the lecture today.
Did you?
Yeah, a load of crap.
Are you likely to use that word on the radio at all?
Sorry. I'm not allowed to use that word.
No, I just asked if you were likely to use that word on the radio.
Oh, well, apparently I just did. So.
Well, yeah, seemingly.
It's 2:30 in the morning.
I'll try and explain that to the station manager.
Well, we're all against censorship. So
yes, of course. Okay. There seem to be increasingly every week more and more things that you can actually say on radio.
Oh.
And still offend some people, but not the majority anymore.
Errol, can I just jump in? And
of course you may, Stuart. Let's talk some UFOs here.
Well, Paul's speech, I must say, Paul's lecture was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, regardless of, you know, how you feel about Wilbert Smith, it was a very informed, very well-organized lecture that people could follow, even if they'd never heard of Wilbert Smith before. And, you know, it held... The other thing with the way Paul spoke was that he, as you might imagine, that there was a lot of humor in his speech, which is not something that you're used to with a ufological lecture. And there was also, for reasons I'm sure that only Paul can explain, frequent slide pictures of Jessica Albert.
Yeah.
And I'm not really quite sure where she fits into the Wilbur Smith story, but I'm sure Paul can explain.
Well, it's his photographic blog. That's what it is, right?
Well, you know, 95% of the audience was male, so you play to your audience.
Well, of course, and you managed to maintain interest and put people to sleep, or not put people to sleep, who didn't care a damn about Wilbert Smith.
Not really. Actually, the very cute blonde that Stuart was referring to left after my lecture and never came back. So, you know, I kept everyone else, but I lost the one that we were all trying to keep.
You realize, of course, that she's with Special Security Air Force.
No, that's fine with me.
Yes. Just making sure that you stick to the agenda.
Paul went through one really strange ritual before he actually began his speech. Mm. There was a picture of Her Majesty the Queen hanging up on the wall, and he lifted it off the wall and placed it on a chair near him, facing him. And then he turned to the audience and said, by way of explanation for what he'd just done, "Now I can say, when I get back home, that I've briefed the Queen on UFOs."
It was my Stephen Greer moment. I thoroughly briefed the Queen on UFOs, and she was amused.
Yeah,
quite amused.
You and Colin Andrews. Oh, yeah. No, that's Margaret Thatcher, wasn't it? Not the Queen. Nearly the same difference, though. Yeah. Okay, Nick Redfern is being extremely quiet. Nick, it's your turn to entertain the audience.
Would you like song and dance?
Well, sure. Tap dancing would be good, as long as you manage not to fall in the sink. That would be kind of nice.
it was a good day, and I think, you know, as Stuart said, it was a small audience, but it was good in the sense that there was a lot of variation. You know, you had Paul doing sort of a straightforward historic look at
Wilbur
Smith, the Canadian side of things, mm-hmm. and then Neil bringing things right up to date with the autopsy, and then, you know, I tried to, as I mentioned to the audience, you know, it was probably one of the few times I've given a lecture on UFOs where UFOs themselves actually didn't feature. It was just, you know, the people who investigate these things and how they get, you know, watched by the security services. And
well, yeah, that too is interesting, and as one of the characters in the X-Files once said, you know, no matter how paranoid you think you are, you're not paranoid enough.
So, you know, it all went well, a good time, and a lot of questions asked, which is always a good sign, and, you know, everybody just hung out, and it all went well, and everybody was chatty, and even Larry Warren turned up from Leicester Eastgate.
You mentioned Gary McKinnon before.
Right.
You know, where do you stand on him? Because did you fall into the camp of thinking or believing that he's a complete idiot and he's brought it all upon himself?
I'm sort of somewhere in the middle as far as he's concerned. Yeah, he did bring it on himself. I think it's unfortunate that they didn't treat him. The British justice didn't treat him in the same way that the earlier hacker who got into various computers that he shouldn't have gotten into, what, three, 4 years ago? You know, I think that the Americans, of course, are really sensitive about the sensitivity, and as Billy Cox points out in his Florida Today article, what the last few years has shown is that United States computer security people have learned absolutely nothing in the last 3 years in beefing up their security.
Yeah, you're quite right. It's if it's almost child's play, it's really very difficult justifying you know, a prosecution, well, an extradition and a prosecution.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There is a
groundswell of support in the UK. I guess you would perhaps expect that, but there is a groundswell of support here for him.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and again, as Billy Cox points out, what is the website, Free Gary McKinnon?
Yeah.
It is the website, and so there's a rising swell of support for him. And I guess, you know, the other thing that concerns them, too, is him saying that he had, although he had a dial-up and the images were substantial that he was trying to get at, he got He got a look at one image of a cigar-shaped object up there against the diameter of the Earth, a cigar-shaped object with domes on the top of it and on its bottom as well, before, you know, the plug was pulled on him, before he was discovered.
Yes, well, that opens up a whole can of worms, actually, doesn't it?
It's, mm-hmm.
What type of cigar-shaped object was it? Who does it belong to?
Well, yeah.
Is it like the other thousands of other cigars that people have seen floating around in the skies, or is it an American made? You know, you can just go on and on with that.
Yeah, yeah. As in the black triangles or the flying triangles that we referenced at the top of the program with Carl Flock.
Yeah.
And Herb Taylor. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks, Errol, by the way, for that. That was very nice. I certainly considered Carl a friend, and it's very sad to see his passing this week, so that was a nice segment you did there.
We met Carl in Roswell, New Mexico in 1997, along with James Mosley and a whole bunch of other lovely people, too, but at the Roswell Inn in the bar there, we sat and had a round table, Mike Woods and Sue Kovios and Mike's wife and Rebecca Shaddy and a whole bunch of people in the bar sitting around nattering. And what I found really interesting was that Carl Flock actually didn't say very much. I think it was Mosley who did most of the talking that evening.
Yeah, well, you know, Mosley's quite a personality, so sometimes you can be overshadowed by a guy like that. We interviewed him for a couple of films we did, and Carl was, he's nothing, and he and I emailed for a few years, and he's always very helpful whenever I'd have questions, and he was a really good interview, so very cooperative, you know, a pleasure to work with. So I think it's a big loss for ufology, especially mm-hmm. serious ufology, whether you agreed with him all the time or not. He took the subject seriously, and, he also had a sense of humor, too, about it and about himself.
Yeah.
I think that was important. He wasn't afraid to poke fun at himself or other people, and, you know, that's fine, too.
Very dry.
Analyst,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So he's a good guy, and, you know, he'll be missed.
Yes. What I found interesting was that the fact that he was a CIA operative and then had all of these credentials, you know, to do with defense, and yet here he was lurking around the UFO field as well.
Yeah, well, we were sort of half-joking here that, you know, given what happened after Phil Klass passed away, it's probably a race to see who can file the first Freedom of Information Act with Carl Flock. I'm sure somebody will do it.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yeah.
To see what might be in his files. You know, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Let me ask you, since all three of you were there, did you guys get a chance to talk to Larry Warren?
Yeah, Larry was kind of, well, he was just a member of the audience. He just came to attend, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's still, full on with trying to get the story out about Bent Waters and Rendlesham Forest and, you know, really get his story still told. And, I consider Larry to be a credible person. I think, you know, he was involved. He knows something of aspects of what went on. He was involved in aspects of the story. And I've always considered him a good person.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect, I was glad to see him there. You know, it was good to see him after so many years again.
This is Stuart Errol. I stood and watched as Paul did some work with him and did an interview with him, and I found it fascinating listening to him. After he'd finished, I said to Paul and Nick, you know, that when you listen to Larry Warren speak, you get the human after effects of Rendlesham. It's easy to sort of sit back and just look at it sort of objectively as a UFO case. But when you talk to, when you hear Larry talk about it, you can, he describes it very vividly, and he describes it with a lot of emotion. And you can see the price he's paid for it and the toll it's taken on him. And, you know, he's still paying that price. His life has been not easy since. And, you can see, as I say, the price he's paid for having involuntarily gone through that experience.
Yeah, I can see that. Stuart, did you by any chance see the Sci-Fi Channel's coverage of the Rendlesham Forest incident?
I didn't, unfortunately.
Oh, too bad. Because that was pretty good. It made it seem to be fairly solid, you know, and was a straight-ahead reportage on what the witnesses had experienced there at the United States nuclear airfield in the United Kingdom, part of the NATO situation there.
Hello, Stuart. This is Wayne, St. John. I had a question about the alien autopsy. Was there... You had mentioned that there were a couple of things that were newly revealed. Could you disclose any of that?
Unfortunately, no, because I've forgotten them.
Oh, that's true.
Another riveting presentation that Stuart was glued to his seat for. But I'm quite sure that my colleague, this is called dumping on somebody.
Yeah, Paul Kimball.
Nick Pope. Nick Redman. Will Ruff. Nick Cook.
What's going on tonight? Too many Nicks. one of the things, Errol, that it's actually not a new thing, but it's one that's largely been forgotten or overlooked, is that there's one section in the film where one of the people in the room in the so-called protection suits brushes past the hand of the creature or dummy or whatever it is and catches the fingers, and the fingers actually move in a jointed fashion, you know, not like as if they were just a latex appendage, if you like, which is one piece, but they actually moved as if they were jointed in the way their finger would be. And you can quite clearly see that when the film is slowed down and you watch it. And again, it's also clear that it was done by accident, that it wasn't an intentional bump into the finger, because it just catches on the clothes of the person.
Whatever it was on the table didn't have rigor mortis.
Well, no, but, I mean, don't forget rigor mortis is something that sets in and then afterwards
it goes away.
Yeah, this is true, too.
And, you know, there are things, like Stuart has said, if Ray really wanted to clear it up, why doesn't he just tell us the name and the address of the place where he got the autopsy table from? You know, why doesn't he tell us where he bought the clock from? Then we could go to them and we could speak to them and say, is there a receipt or do you remember this guy turning up 12 years ago specifically looking for a vintage 40s autopsy table? And if they do, then I would be happy with that, you know, but the mystery or the puzzle is that Ray won't do that. Or hasn't done that, I should say.
It's
things like, these aren't so much my views, these are the sort of things that Neil brought up, in his lecture, pointing out why he believes there's more to the story. The fact that, you know, the Ray's explanation has left as many questions as, you know, as if there wasn't even a confession in the first place, if you like. So.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. I tend to vacillate between, yeah, right, and, well, maybe.
Nick told me something earlier today, which I'd never heard before about the alien autopsy, which was that at one point, a scalpel being held reflects back on the cameraman, and you can look at the scalpel and see a reflection of the cameraman holding the camera, and he is dressed in one of the biological suits. Well, you know, if they're faking it, why go to the trouble of sticking the guy in that?
Good question.
I've seen the film at least 20 times. I have it, and for all that I can see and all the people that have viewed it, I really think it's real. That's my feeling about it. It cannot be fake. That's how I feel about it. That's just me.
I think it can be faked. I mean, you know, certainly Nick, and I speak for myself obviously as well, it's not a desire to believe in the fact that the alien autopsy footage is the footage of a real alien. It's almost irrelevant. It's not really, but it's a desire to know the full truth, and there is a strong suspicion that we haven't been told the full truth. I think that's what irks and irritates. And as Nick said, you know, with Santilli being the slippery character that he is, the situation now is even clouder than it was, you know, 3 or 4 months ago.
And Popcorn, who's sitting here, just to flash me a piece of paper that says a Unit 731 body, ?
Well, you know, I mean, again, this is one of the big questions. Is it a hoax? Is it a deformed human being? Is it alien? Is it something we haven't even considered? You know, it is one of these questions, Errol, where I think, you know, like a lot of the UFO subjects, we end up with more questions than answers. You know, I think all we can do is just, you know, just keep digging into it and just see where it all leads and or where it doesn't. And I think right now, you know, things are at stalemate. The confession that should have laid it to rest, I think, actually, ironically, is in some quarters, has just escalated the controversy even more. Mm. But then maybe that's what Ray wants.
Well, he certainly wanted the Anton Deck movie to be well attended and get a piece of that pot. So.
I'll tell you, Errol, from my perspective, I'm in the dissenting judgment on the majority here. It falls into the yeah, right category. Time to move on. There's a lot of other really good things to spend our time looking at. And I don't really particularly care how it was hoaxed or what the background is on it, because life's short. You know, there are better things to look into.
Mm-hmm.
But I also understand the impetus for people who want to, you know, continue looking into it, because it, you know, it is curious. It's an interesting story to see how it might have all been done. I just want to say, by the way, because Stuart's been kind enough to thank us. You know, thanks to Stuart, A, for putting Nick and I up, along with my cameraman and Nick's wife. But also, you know, for putting on the conference, it took a lot of effort, and and I hope he puts on many more.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, gentlemen.
he's such a good host and such a nice guy that you know, he almost makes me want to have Canada, you know, forsake the Dominion status and return to the tender embrace of the Empire. But
Stuart Miller Day.
The Stuart Miller Day in Canada, yeah. You know,
well,
instead of Victoria Day.
Yeah, I was about to say, we need something to replace Victoria Day, that's for sure.
Victor Alban Day.
Yeah.
But there's something I don't understand, because I'm not British, and you are, Errol, so perhaps you can help me out, because Nick's trying to get me to head into Altrincham later and look for mucky women. Now, I don't know, like, is this a good thing?
Well, it depends on which side of the washcloth you sit, I guess. Listen, we are out of time, gentlemen, and we can let you go to do what you need to do immediately now. Thank you, Nick Redfern. Thank you, Paul Kimball. We'll talk to you when you get back to Canada. And Stuart Miller, thank you, sir, and we'll talk to you next month.
It's a pleasure. I look forward to it, Errol.
Bye,
thanks, Errol.
The latest edition of UFO Review is available online at uforeview.net, either as a PDF or as a doc file. Some very funny stuff in there, and some very serious stuff, too. Go grab yourselves a copy. It's free. Wayne St. John in studio with me tonight for part two of E.T. First Contact. And Wayne has been involved in all of this stuff for 37 years or more, which is almost as long as it was since you were in the original Toronto production of Hair.
Yeah, absolutely.
All those years ago.
All those years.
And then part of Music Machine and the Keith Hampshire CBC years. Gospel choir.
Yeah.
You're just an amazingly active man. You play the pan pipes that we heard
Indeed.
In One Love for the Planet there. You play keyboards, guitar. You have a beautiful website, which is, give us that address.
It is WSAINTJ.com.
W Saint J.
Yep.
.com.
Yes.
Yeah, go take a look at that. There's many hours of actually really interesting reading there.
Indeed.
And a lot of you in detail, singer, songwriter, producer, promoter, musician, UFO researcher. And it's the UFO researcher side which is featured in this half hour. You started out last week telling us about a young man, as he was then, named David, in the Queen and Leslie area of Toronto.
Yes.
Who had numerous contacts with beings from a craft.
Right.
A ship.
A ship.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
A flying saucer.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This goes back at least 40 years. Or more, 45, you know, when he was just a baby, really.
Yeah.
But the whole thing about what I've discovered is the story I'll tell later is, I mean, he couldn't have made this up if he tried. I mean, it's, when you hear the story later, you'll see what I mean. It's just one of many stories that that he basically unraveled and uncovered it, and has with a crystal clear mind speaking about it and writing it down,
And has total recall of it. No mind blocks. No mind use of blocks. Hypnosis.
No, he never watched Star Trek. He never watched any UFO shows. Nothing.
Science fiction.
Nothing. Nothing like that. Yeah. So. Yeah,
I guess he didn't need to. He was too busy living it, huh?
He was busy living it.
Yeah.
He was, yeah. That's the whole thing. I think it stole the whole subject with the extraterrestrials that were involved are still around today. That is the really startling thing that I've coming to realize.
And David is not convinced. He knows that they are extraterrestrial.
No, he's pretty well convinced now. He's had more memories of the craft coming in. He knew when they were coming in. It was mental telepathy before they'd come in.
Mm-hmm.
And the story I'll tell tonight is really, it's just I can't believe, you know, that he recalled all of this.
So,
yeah. And I wanted to talk about just the concept of which I titled this segment, E.T., First Contact. And I basically wanted to just to put it in people's minds that that basically, you know, that E.T., First Contact, it's assuming in the title that there will be E.T., First Contact, when in fact... the first contact really in this sort of realm really speaks to the masses finally getting to see all of this that only very few people have actually come in contact and seen and witnessed and been on board these crafts, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in pre-first contact mode, which has been going on for eons. It's been going for a long time. From all the information that I've gleaned and gathered from many sources, it does speak of the intangible, of the things that you can't see, you can't touch, but you know they're there if you've experienced it or you've been around the experiences. It's a good thing. I think that we're going to find out that E.T. First Contact will equate to world peace. Now, that may be a bold statement in itself, but I think that the whole concept of which Dr. Michio Kaku, a theorist...
string theorist, yeah.
Yes. And he basically goes into classes of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Like we on this planet right now are considered a zero class civilization, and he speculates to go on to say that there may be as many as class four civilizations, which would be astoundingly, you know,
astounding.
Yes.
Yes.
High in
yes.
intellect
beyond
and,
description.
Indeed. So yeah, and but I want to propose to people to think about this in a slightly different way, in that in a pre-first contact mode, we are experiencing things only haphazardly and certain people here and there. And of course, there's lots of reasons for that, I believe. I've heard as many as 50,000 ETs, ET races are here amongst us, but you could never tell.
50,000
around the world, scattered around the world.
50,000 beings.
Beings, yes.
Okay,
right.
Yeah.
And that's not a lot.
No,
but
not when you consider the population of the planet, and there are certainly are some very strange people out there.
That's true. And in the case of Dave's story, which keeps coming up, is that these beings, these people, highly intelligent, very benevolent, loving people, will go into a neighborhood like that neighborhood, that Queen and Leslie, a rough neighborhood. Mm. And it seems like they actually could change the minds of the store owners and the people that they would run into, and the level of prejudice and things like that have actually sort of changed from what I can tell in all the stories that I've now gotten from Dave's whole life series of stories. And so I think that this pre-first contact mode, if people start to really open their eyes, like look around, look at the sky, look in the evening, and look in that night sky, and you will see that there are more things going on than we could possibly even gather or grasp. I wanted to just mention that last summer, right in the area of Girard and Broadview, I was at a mall, and I was looking up in the sky, and in a cloud was a silver craft. Beautiful. It was very distinctive, and I could see it moving in and out, and it stayed there 5 or 6 minutes, and I stood it with my head craned, my neck craned back, and looking at this craft. And that, I got to say, was the first time that I consciously remember ever seeing a craft myself, other than the story I told 2 weeks ago on my last show with that had to do with the stars. Now, to get into the story that I wanted to tell about little Davy. As a boy, he, at one day in the summer, he had had a contact. And after the contact, early in the day, he basically was very content and very, and also had been given some knowledge and certain information. And what happened was his mother was invited by a girlfriend and a man that was rooming with her to go to a corn roast it was either Oshawa or Pickering. And so they proceeded to take that long drive to this corn roast. And when they got there, little Davy's looking around and he sees the corn. It's just tons of corn and there's like vats of butter everywhere. And he looks at it and he says to himself, well, I guess they won't be having that tonight. And so what happened was he and his mother found himself in the middle of a couple of good old boys or worse that actually were contemplating raping his mother. Mm. And like I said, Davy was sitting there. He was fine. He was smiling. He was saying to himself, this ain't gonna happen. And he knew that his mom was in danger to a degree, but he had also known that could nothing happen. So they are around this fire, big fire, and on to the back of them is where they're cooking on the grills, and they got all the stuff going. Suddenly, it's just starting to get dark. A craft comes out of the sky. It's probably 100 meters in diameter. It comes over a field towards them, and the men who are getting ready to do their thing, they were startled by the craft. They had been drinking, had beer and everything, and they were ready to party. And they started throwing, they threw the bottles at the craft. Hmm. So the craft suddenly just jets back about a couple hundred feet, lands in the field, which they could see, just a couple hundred feet in front of them. And the guys who were all messed up over what had just happened, they were first frightened and then they were mad. And they took their beer bottles and they were throwing them at the craft. And they started to run at the craft. And suddenly, as they were running, they didn't even get really near it. Several men that were standing outside the craft did something, whether it was something that was shot at these men, but they all got violently ill right there on the spot. They got sick as dogs. They couldn't stop puking. and then the craft suddenly swooped in over top, and a couple of men grabbed the mother, left Davy there.
A couple of the crewmen. A
couple of the crewmen from the craft grabbed the mom and took her, whisked her away. And they had left her purse, so just a minutes later, they came back and got the purse. And
that's considerate of them, wasn't
it? Yeah. And the crewman, as he grabbed the purse, he violently kicked this big bonfire that they had going and took off. And Dave was just sitting there like he was just content. He knew that his mom was going to be safe, and whatever he was told to keep him calm, he was absolutely calm. And then when so now the mother's gone, and they have to drive back to Toronto without the mother and explain that one. Like, where did she go? Mm-hmm. So they proceeded to get in the car, and there was a little boy with the other lady, and there was the man who came with them in the first place was the one who set them up at this so-called party or whatever it was going to be. And I think he knew what was going to happen as well, that the mother was going
there to... There was a plan to assault her. Yeah.
Absolutely, they were going to assault her. And so when they got back in the car, the man, he kept puking. He just couldn't stop, and it was a dry heaving. And the little boy, I forget his name now, I was going to mention his name, but I just can't remember it right now, but he started to cry. And he was with Dave. He was a little bit younger than Dave.
Huh.
And he started to cry. When the man was kind of puking out of the car constantly, he started to cry, and he cried the whole trip all the way back home, and as if the whole thing shook him up. With the sighting of the craft and et cetera, and the whole kerfuffle of getting the mom out of there, and they went back home and spoke to the mother's mom, which is David's grandmother, and the grandmother seemed content herself that she'd be back tomorrow and not to worry about anything, and that basically is that story.
And sure enough, she was back the following day.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Have you talked to this family other than David?
Well, not really. No, I haven't. Now, the mom passed away, unfortunately. She went with a lot of secrets with her. She also didn't seem to be cognizant of what was going on like David was. She didn't seem to realize that who they were. You know, if they have that flashy thingy, that blanks your mind. I could see that they could have used it on her over and over again, just to keep her calm, because she wasn't a calm person. She was a very, you know, on edge kind of thing. And it did look as if she was kept unaware of a lot of this stuff. And I could see how they could do that. They could get away with that.
Now, you're going to get David to tell his story into a microphone very soon.
Very soon, yes.
Ah.
Yeah.
Because that'll be interesting to hear firsthand.
Absolutely.
You know, as long as it's okay with David that we play bits and pieces of it.
Yeah, he won't mind at all. He won't mind. Because he suffered at the hands of people around him most of his life because of this incident. And it seemed like, you know, the government got involved, the American government got involved. Everybody was there. Everybody came out to this field to see what was going on.
Well, we'll hear more of this story as the weeks go by, right?
Absolutely. And and I have even another story I can tell you.
I have a very quick one. I got a call from Tom Theophanis, who is the director of investigation from MUFON Ontario. He started the conversation with, "I want to report a UFO," and I gagged with him. And then it turned out that, yes, in fact, he did, up by Canada's Wonderland, daylight sighting of a cigar earlier this week.
Really?
So he's not sure who to report that to now.
Hey, Tom, hey. So you finally got to see their one. Ah, great. Excellent. Yeah.
Wayne St. John, thank you, sir. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
Thank you.
Good having you along, Popcorn. Jim Pacheco in Montreal and Julian McNabb out there in Master Control. We should talk to you next Saturday night. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli.